I need a demonstrator. I need someone who can demonstrate with their hand how an earthquake looks or how an earthquake forms.
We're in Mrs. Pitt's fourth grade class at Ingalls Elementary School.
Take your time, think about it.
So, we were watching a video about earthquakes and how they transform.
All eyes are on a little girl who holds up her fists to show how tectonic plates put pressure on each other and cause earthquakes.
Show them. You need to show them.
And when an earthquake forms.
Mrs. Pitts likes to teach with all the senses, using movements, storytelling, and multimedia. Her students are hooked even before she plays videos of a street scene during an earthquake.
Mm-hmm. And look, see the bus? See, look.
It's about me.
You know something is happening for sure now.
Scientific concepts and vocab words are woven in with personal stories.
The good part about earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, tsunamis, the good part is because of the new technology we have, we can somewhat predict them. Remember I told you yesterday that my friend Mrs. DePlessis was in New Orleans? They knew 2 days before Katrina really, really hit hard that it was going to be a problem. So she was able to what they call evacuate. Evacuate means to leave quickly.
Pretty soon, they dive into their textbooks to read about the work of seismologists and the latest earthquake prediction technology. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. Today, we'll talk to Mrs. Pitts about the Hickman Mills School District, where she's something of a legend. It's part of a collaboration with reporter Barb Shelley, who's spending the year hanging out in two classrooms at Ingalls Elementary. One of those classes used to be taught by Mrs. Pitts, who is technically retired now. That's why she's able to join us here in the studio. Hi, Mrs. Pitts. Can I call you Marcia?
Good morning. Yes, you may.
What does it mean to be technically retired?
Technically, I am retired. But because of the skill levels and because of my love for teaching, I return to sub and to assist teachers as needed. And at the particular time that you hear the lesson, I was subbing for a fourth grade class at Ingalls Elementary while the teacher was on maternity leave.
So what drew you to teaching initially? Because you've been in this district for, what, 30 years?
About 30 years, yes. It really starts back to when my own son was in school, and I really did not like children. I started working with an early childhood school because I needed to supplement my child's daycare provider. And I just began to love it more and more and more.
It's so surprising to hear a legendary teacher say, I didn't used to like kids.
That was at the time I was 19 years old. And I just, that's not what I was going to do. I had planned to go to Broadway. I had already, my speech was ready for my Tony Award and my Academy Award.
I've got a few of those speeches in my back pocket.
I was just diverted for the time being. But my hopes and my dreams was to go to Broadway. But a prayer friend of mine at church saw something in me and began to cultivate it and to begin to nurture it and begin to show me what I could do to assist children. And it's just been my life's profession for the last 42 years.
You started teaching in the Hickman Mills District in 1988. What was the district like then?
The district was very, very interesting. I thought about it after Barb, spoke with Barb. The district itself was just vibrant. We had such a large population. We had such a large district that was really, really thriving as a direct result of the businesses that we had in the community at the time. When I went to Ingalls Elementary, Ingalls was just overflowing. We had such strong parent support. We had anything you needed and wanted was there at Ingalls.
Can you describe a little more what you mean by anything you needed and wanted was there? What kinds of things would you as a teacher need that at that time was just so available?
If I needed assistance in the classroom, we had parents, we had our room mothers. At Ingalls, we had a set of parents that came every single day. They were our lunch aides. They were our roommates. We never ran our own copies. We never, ever laminated or cut out anything.
Just because there were so many parents there doing it?
And they were so good at it.
How has that changed? What is different about the district since 1988?
Our economics. The economics of the district and the economics of the country simply changed. Those parents who were able to leave to a higher value property left. We had Bendix that moved. We had Merriam Labs that moved. We had Richard Skabauer Air Force Base that all of those parents used to work for, and they lived within that district. Well, when those corporations more or less disbanded, so did our parents' support as well.
How does that translate into what you saw in the classroom? How did you first start noticing changes?
Well, we started noticing changes, I'm thinking in maybe the earlier mid-90s. We began to notice, we don't have the same parent support that we had before. Many of our parents had begun to leave our district. Many of their husbands received promotions and things, and they were able to move out. We just saw a rapid change, and it really was a rapid change. It was a change that you didn't see coming. I'm pretty sure someone knew it was coming, but you didn't see it coming. It was very rapid and very, very difficult to handle.
So, you know, our reporter, Barb Shelley, who has been spending time in these classrooms, noted that the parents who came to pick up children when she was visiting were often in uniform of some kind. Can you talk about who is in your district now, with the parents, the kids?
I'm thinking we have the same wide variety of parents. Our parents are now working harder, longer. Our children are having to stay at school longer.
Longer hours.
Because of the economics, the family economics that they're going through. Many of our parents have 2-3 jobs. And it's just very, very difficult for parents to be a part of this child's education when you're working 2 jobs or 3 jobs, overnight jobs. And it's very difficult. Again, it's an all direct response to our economy.
Barb also gave us a breakdown of the demographic changes in the district since 1991. It's gone from 60% white to 11% white and 37% black to 76% black. And 100% of the students are now on subsidized lunch, compared with less than half when they started tracking that in 1995. Do those changes affect you as a teacher?
Not really. Yes and no. Yes, they do affect you because you want your children to always have the best of everything. And when parents are busy working and parents are busy providing or trying to provide, we as the school systems, we're having to bring up the rear for the kids. And it's also just difficult to see children there every day, all day. But that's just a choice.
When we look at the numbers for these demographic changes, what does race have to do with this bigger picture in your mind? Because for me, there's this uncomfortable thing of numbers side by side where it shows on one, you know, a district is struggling. And then in the same breath, we're talking about how the number of black students has gone up. And I want to sort of dive into that relationship a little bit with you, because clearly, you know, no one's saying that these two things are the same. No one's saying that black students signify lower quality in education. But there are these numbers side by side that people talk about side by side when they're looking at the demographic changes.
I'm not going to be able to say that. That is not going to be true. It may look true, but I don't think it's going to be true. When the district began to change, I did not see a lapse or a disintegration of the educational system, but I did see a disintegration of the economic system. I did see a disintegration of the home system, but I did not see an educational breakdown. We're still working as hard as we did before to educate children. And we're still using some of the same strategies and incorporating new strategies to ensure that children are learning and children are retaining that knowledge. So it's the economic change that really strikes you. I'm going to have to keep going back to that economic piece.
Well, let's hear from the district superintendent, Dennis Carpenter, on this. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine.
What do you hear in those numbers? I'll repeat them. The district's gone from 60% white to 11% white, 37% black to 76% black, 100% of students now on subsidized lunch. What do you hear there?
So as I try and digest those data, and I appreciate you bringing forth the 1995 data that preceded me. I hear the stories, but I don't know that I've looked at the 95 numbers. So what you see in those numbers is an acceleration in the number of students of color. And you also see an acceleration in students that are living at or below the poverty line. And I try and juxtapose those numbers with what I know about our teaching staff. And our teaching staff today, 87% of our certified staff do not reside within the geographic boundaries of our district. And that does not mean that we have the resources there that they're accustomed to live in that area. So I get it, but that's a reality. And when you combine that with the fact that about 75% of our certified teachers are white and 90% of the kids they're teaching are kids of color, there's a cultural and a racial disconnect that exists despite our best efforts.
What does that mean for the students and for the teachers?
What that means is that we have to embrace those cultural differences in the space called school, and we have to really get engaged in what I like to refer to, or the research refers to, as culturally relevant teaching and pedagogy. So that's something that we've embraced. We have a clear racial equity focus in our district, where we've developed equity teams at each site to really look at how we're educating students and how can we start to interrupt that predictably lower performance of kids of color, especially economically disadvantaged kids of color in our district.
From the ground level, I mean, just when you think about day-to-day interactions between students and their teachers and how that relates to the kind of education kids are receiving and just how they feel throughout the day when they're at school, what is it, when you're looking at it from that point of view, not from a numbers point of view, what is it that you see that creates the need for what you're talking about? Can you talk about like the kind of situation that you want, that you're hoping to change?
Yes. When we think about the issue, and it seems like it's the race piece is significant. It's an issue of culture. It's an issue of consciousness. And of course, it's an issue of color. So how do we understand those differences and be able to embrace those differences? Let's just give an example. If we have a classroom of students that are 90% and in some cases 100% kids of color in our district, then how do we select textbooks, or how do we select supplemental reading material for those students that in which those students can see themselves in the text, thus engaging at a higher level and producing higher levels of performance? We've been embarking upon that with some partnership with PrepKC and also in our equity team efforts. And we had a little girl the other day, I had a school principal report to me. She said, "Dr. Carpenter, you'll never guess what a kid said to me today." And I said, "What is that?" And they talked about this story of, for once, I don't have to read about little white boys and their dogs.
You know,
so that's pretty significant when you're talking about engaging students in the learning process. And that's a shift we're making, and there's some discomfort associated with that, but we believe in the long run it's going to be best for our students.
I want to get right back to you on that, but Marcia is nodding vigorously, and I want to hear from you because you've been in the district for a long time, and you are maybe coming from a more similar background to some of those students. Like, how do you see yourself having an advantage in that respect when compared to other teachers?
Yes. When you work with children that look like you, you understand where they're coming from, but you understand as well where they need to go. Dr. Carpenter talked about the advantage of looking at materials for students. That has been one of my issues for years. As a part of the Teachers Association, we did that for years. We looked at materials that were placed in front of children. Was it commensurate for everybody? Did everybody see themselves as a part of the reading material? For years, we looked at our Hispanic children. We looked at our Black children. We looked at all of our children, ensuring that materials were put in front of them that had them in the material. I read better when I see myself. I read better, I understand better, I relate better when I can make that text to self connection.
Well, especially when it's an example of a concept that you're supposed to be learning.
Exactly.
Well, let's pivot a little bit. Dennis Carpenter, you are fairly new in the district. You've been here since 2013.
Yes, ma'am.
And I want to know how you would assess the strengths and challenges of the district currently.
I believe our district has multiple strengths. I think we have a clear strength in our core group of teachers that have really invested in the work of our district. You know, it's oftentimes we tend to look at a cup as half empty when really it's half full. So we really try to leverage those resources with those persons who are dedicated to the work in our district. So our teaching staff, it's a strength. I would say that our leadership core is this year is as strong as it's ever been in our district. And I believe our strategic framework that we put together is a strength of the district. As it relates to our greatest challenge is that we live in a segment of the Kansas City metropolitan area that's probably the most underserved and disinvested in portion of this community.
Can you tell me what you mean by those words, underserved and disinvested in just in plain language?
Well, you know, if you look at the district and its geographic location, there is no city seat of sorts for the district. It's just a portion of the community. So there's a resource disadvantage. When you talk about business supports, there's some opportunities to really, really strengthen that area. When I think about, and I heard Ms. Pitts mention some of the businesses that were there and thriving, well, lots of those businesses benefited from tax abatements. And those abatements caused the district to not garner dollars to effectively educate the students that it might have needed.
Gotcha.
And that same trend is taking place now in the district as we look at new development going on, one of the largest economic development projects in the history of our state. And that development is going to see significant abatements. And there's another one on the horizon that will experience the same. So until there's a higher level of investment that would not only invest in our students, but also invest in our community in terms of jobs and opportunities, then we won't change that socioeconomic tide that Ms. Pitts so eloquently discussed this morning. So important.
Would you say that your biggest challenge then is a funding challenge?
I would not necessarily call it a district funding challenge. I would call it an economic investment challenge for the entire area.
So not just for the schools, but for everything.
Because
for the
school, let's just agree that the school is simply a small microcosm of the community. So when you talk about results and outcomes and you say this district is high performing as measured by state assessments, you can probably look at that community and it's also thriving at a high level. So when you talk about a low level of investment in a school district community, then don't be surprised that the academic outcomes aren't where you want them to be also.
Dennis, You were born and raised in Georgia. What drew you to the Hickman Mills District? I mean, you came here to work for this district.
To, you know, there's always this narrative out there as it relates to the educability of economically disadvantaged kids of color. And my work throughout my career has always been one of interrupting that narrative. I believe in the education of kids of color. I believe in the education of students that come from a low socioeconomic status. And I believe that our democracy depends on our ability to get this right. And I take that responsibility pretty serious in terms of my professional practice.
You're talking about disrupting a really huge narrative. And that's kind of what I was getting at when I was wanting to look at the numbers and say, but we can't mean by these numbers what it would be so easy to think we mean. You know what I, what do you think people don't understand? I mean, if there's a narrative out there that's wrong, what is it that people aren't getting?
I think if I could put it in simplest terms, the biggest thing that we struggle with getting is the difference between what's equal and what's equitable. I think we always tend to lean to doing things the same way for everyone, and that's equal. But I think that we struggle with the issue of equity, meaning when the starting place is different for different kids in different communities, then the supports that they receive have to also be differentiated. And we struggle with that in our state assessment systems. We struggle with that in our state accountability systems. We struggle with that locally in communities. You know, we got this whole notion of early learning. And I'll use that as an example because that's one thing that we really, really invested in our district is high quality early learning for all kids. And to make that story pretty short, what I'm going to offer is currently when you hear about early learning, everyone wants to have those opportunities for all 4-year-olds. But the research clearly states that our high quality early learning is most integral for our students that come from poverty. So why wouldn't we be why would we not be equal, instead be equitable in differentiating funding for things like early learning?
If Marcia, if I could give you a magic wish that's just magically going to be granted for the Hickman Mills School District, could you tell me what that wish would be? I want to be clear, I can't grant you a magic wish, but I want to know what it would be anyway.
I would want to wish that our district and that the investors in our district and that investors in our nation will look at our district. Our district has the capacity to grow. Our district has the capacity to be a thriving, vibrant district. But we need that help. And that's all it is to it. So my wish is, come back to Hickman Mills. We're the best that we will ever be, and we're going to be. We're the best.
Marcia Pitts, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Marcia is a retired fourth grade teacher who can't stay out of the classroom in Ingalls Elementary, and Hickman Mills Superintendent Dennis Carpenter, be in touch.
Thank you.
We'll be providing ongoing coverage of the district from reporter Barb Shelley. Up next, when KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll look back on the life of an international male model who spent his sunset years tearing tickets at a Kansas City movie theater. I met Bob Smith when I was a teenager. He worked at the video store in Westport. Bob was exactly the kind of adult I hoped to impress. He was stylish and sophisticated, but for the first several times I met him, he didn't seem to remember me. One day, instead of handing me the gloomy new wave French film I requested, because yes, I was that kind of teenager, he let out an exasperated sigh and asked, "Why does such a young person watch such sad movies?" That was the beginning of our friendship. I wouldn't find out for another 10 years or so that he was friends with the actress who starred in the movie I requested that day, or that he'd been a famous male model in New York and Paris at the height of his career. Photos from that career are currently on display in the lobby of the Tivoli, where Bob tore tickets until the end of his life. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR Central Standard, the story of Bob Smith, the owner of the Tivoli where Bob worked, is Jerry Harrington. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Gina.
I remember you from those days as well.
Oh, yes. I remember you, too.
We don't need to talk about it. Do you remember meeting Bob?
Not really. I worked at the Bijou at the time, which became the Tivoli. And he just, on weekends, he was always there. And we went out to dinner one night, and I wasn't quite sure about this guy. But
why weren't you sure about him?
You know, I was young. I mean, I was 25 years younger than him, and I'd never met anyone like him.
What was it about him that seemed different?
Well, like you said, he was sophisticated, but really down to earth. Wasn't pretentious at all. And he was a little guarded, you know. It took a long while to really get to know Bob. I mean, there's one story where I got his sense of humor, and that's when I knew I liked him.
What's that story?
Well, you know, he took care of his five maiden aunts raised Bob.
I think it was seven.
Really?
Yeah,
that's the thing about Bob. You never really know the whole story.
True.
And the last one, Gladys, was still alive and hanging on, and he really didn't plan on staying in the area.
Yeah, he was in Sweet Springs, which,
Sweet Springs, Missouri, yeah, near Marshall. And he would drive all the way in every weekend. But he looked at me, goes, you know, it was in the middle of the winter. He says, some days I just want to leave all the windows open, or maybe put an extra coat of wax on the floor. And, I mean, he would never have done that, but I got his humor. And I said, okay, gallows humor, I like this guy. And
yeah, he was kind of an underground celebrity in Kansas City from his perch at the video store and then later at the bottom of the stairs at the Tivoli where he tore tickets. Why do you think that was?
You know, I don't. There was just something about Bob. Really, I mean, really there was, and he was, it just came to him naturally. I mean, you know, he was very present all the time, and he was very authentic at all times, and people gravitated towards that. Plus, you know, he was pretty smooth, you know, there wasn't a lot of rough edges to Bob.
I also worked at the Tivoli, and I sometimes did that same post Bob did, and people would kind of sometimes put their tickets in their mouth for a second while they fumbled with their keys and then hand me the slobbery ticket. I asked Bob about that once, and he said that no one did that to him, which I have to assume people just noticed him in a different way. He didn't recede into the background.
And he was older. He was dignified. He had a dignity to them that people responded. I mean, I know that a lot of my employees, sometimes people treat them at that station as sort of, you know, just like they're virtually non-existent. But Bob, you couldn't do that.
Right. And that was partly he was not only charming, but also had a near military level adamance about certain rules.
Oh, yes. No, even with me, you know, I tried to correct, you know, let him go easy on an old couple that went down the wrong way down the stairs.
Yeah.
Because we go the British way in the Tivoli.
Up on the left, down on the left.
Yes. And he made them go back up the stairs and go down the right way.
Let's talk a little bit more, though, about that way that he connected with people, and then we'll get to his background, his history, his career. We're talking about Bob Smith, who was kind of a legend in Westport. I one time was talking to him over fortune cookies, and he got a fortune that said something like, an hour with friends is worth more than 10 hours with strangers. And I was surprised that he said he wasn't sure he agreed. And we were talking about the difference between friends and strangers. And I said, well, you know, you can't always neatly distinguish the two. There are people who you see a lot, but you don't know them very well. But they're kind of, they populate your life in ways that people don't understand. If you're waiting at the bus stop, that person who's always at the stop at the same time, that kind of thing. And he said, that's my life at the bottom of the stairs.
Yes.
Can you say what that means to you?
Well, you know, but I think a lot of people really felt close to Bob that he did not feel that necessarily. I mean, it wasn't like he didn't like them or something. He just wasn't close. It was hard to get close, really close to Bob. I don't even know how close I was in some ways. I mean, there was always a part of him that he kept to himself. But You know, I mean, I went over to his apartment a lot. We had, went out to dinner. I mean, you know, we did, we hung out together too, but I don't know. I mean, Bob's sense of friendship, I mean, it was sympathique. He would say, you know, sympathique, meaning there was some sympathy between him and someone else. And that's what he responded to. But he was, he liked people. I mean, it's very rare that he didn't like somebody. I can't even think of one right now.
When I spent some years interviewing Bob, hoping to write his biography, still somewhat hoping that, but I have just a mess of notes. And he, it was very hard to get to know. And every time there was sort of a breakthrough, he would become a little hard to reach after that. Breakthroughs like letters that he gave me, a pile of letters that his estranged father sent to him after he had become a famous fashion model. As soon as I read those letters, it took about 6 months for him to answer a phone call. Also letters between him and his former partner, Eddie, who had lived in Paris. And again, a long lull, I think, because I realized at that point that they had actually broken up before he came to the United States. And he never really talked about the breakup. He always spoke of him and Eddie as a lifelong partnership.
Right.
And things like that. There was an unknowableness to Bob. But there was also his patterns. The way he lived in the city were so idiosyncratic, so particular to him. And that's maybe like how he thought of who he really was. You know, he had four shots of espresso and a chocolate chip cookie every time he went to the coffee shop. He only drove down Main Street to get anywhere. Right. If it was not right off of Main Street, he could not go there.
Exactly.
Like, he had young people who worked for him who were his best, you know, the people he interacted with were less than half his age.
Oh, I know. Yeah. But, yeah, but then he had his friends in the past that would come visit, and you really, they didn't mingle. You know, I didn't meet some of the people of his past, except for Claudia, his lifelong childhood friend. I did get to meet her, and she was wonderful.
Well, not everyone knew Bob's backstory. What do you think it's important for people to know about his career as a model?
Gee, I just know anecdotes. I mean, the interesting thing was he did not go to Paris to be a model. He wanted to be a fashion designer, and he just sort of went. But that's the way Bob's life was. Things just happened. He said, but he always said, you and I are lucky people. And he was very lucky. He would just go, and he just fell into this job as a fashion model. He just went with it. I think it was fairly easy for him to do. I think he had to learn some things, but I never got the sense that it was difficult for him.
Well, I want to talk to someone who worked with Bob for the part of his life that his closest friends here didn't experience. Photographer and filmmaker Jerry Schatzberg is with us from New York. You probably know Jerry Schatzberg's work, even if you don't realize it. He took iconic photographs of musicians like Bob Dylan or the Rolling Stones. He's the director of the cult film Panic in Needle Park, and he also did some truly artful fashion photography. Bob was one of his models. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Talk to me about the era of fashion photography we're talking about, the era when you and Bob worked together.
Well, I worked as a photographer about 11 years, and I don't know when Bob started, because I started as an assistant, and Bob had worked for the photographer that I worked for as a model. Now, I loved the way he worked, and you know, for male model, they're mostly a companion unless they're actually modeling the clothes, but and that's the way I use him mostly. I've got a spread here of photographs that I use Bob, and they're all different, and he just was so pliable. You could just ask him to, whatever you would ask him to do, he was able to do. He understood that. Probably if he wanted a career in acting, he would have had it, and he would have been very good at it.
Talk to me about that, though, the similarity between acting and modeling in the kind of photography you were doing. Because when people think about modeling, I think they might have a misunderstanding about the level of creativity people are bringing to that, or the level of, that there is an art happening.
I can't say they're the same. They're similar. I mean, of course, there's a lot more that goes into acting and reacting. But I would a lot of the time set up a situation, and I'd book the models the same way they cast for a film. And I had a favorite female model also, and they worked beautifully together. And I've got a shot here that I did for Vogue, where there's a female and Bob standing outside a milk truck. They were buying milk to feed their cat. They're both in evening clothes. Obviously, we were trying to sell the evening dress. I mean, tuxedo, I think in I've got about 10, 12 photographs here. He's in a tuxedo maybe 8 times. So he was always a companion. I'd take him to the fish market early in the morning when all the regulars were there, and you can imagine what kind of people are fishmongers, just selling and carrying and carting and pushing. And I'd have these two people in evening clothes having breakfast there. You know, they've come down to the fish market, something probably out of my life, earlier part of my life. I've got one here where there's a couple pushing a child in a stroller, and there's a balloon hanging off the stroller, and the balloon is covering Bob's head. So Bob is really the balloon man walking there. So, you know, we always find a little story to tell with it. And fortunately for male models, their career is longer than female models. And so Bob lasted quite a while. Probably it's funny what the other Jerry said about...
We have two Jerrys.
Yeah, about not liking a sad film. Why did you go see that sad film? He probably wouldn't have liked any of my films, early films anyhow, because they were all sad and difficult. But we had a great relationship. You know, I knew about his private life. I knew Eddie. If we were out on a job, yeah, we'd have lunch or dinner or whatever it was. But he was just very well known in the industry, and it seems strange or interesting to see the difference, because he was very sophisticated at what he did, because fashion is a sophisticated world, and then to go back to the country. But he came from the country, you know. I knew about his great aunts, or you know. So I knew some of his past, not that well. And as the other Jerry said, I don't think you ever knew Bob that well. I just learned about his breakup with Eddie, which was sad because I thought they were a terrific couple.
When you think about working with him and what he brought to your photographs, is there something beyond his image that is influencing what those photographs ultimately looked like? Something about the way he conducted himself on set during the job? What is the influence he had over the final product?
Well, first of all, he understood what I was trying to get at. So I didn't have to worry too much about getting it. You know, if I'd say, it's early in the morning, you're buying milk to feed the cat, that you're out walking, you've just come home from an evening. He knew how to act, how to portray. Then in another photograph, I've just got him in a deep embrace with a woman. It's a perfume ad, and he just had whatever I would ask him to do, he's able to do it. Another one, they've just missed the ferry. I'm just trying to set up a situation where I can show the woman's clothes, but I just want a situation. And you can see in the expression in his face and the angst that would go on. I've got another one where there's a couple sitting in a small convertible Jaguar, and it's raining, and they've got an umbrella covering them, and they're both laughing because it's just the joie de vivre, you know, life, and And, you know, I was able to get things like that from Bob.
Well, Jerry, hang on. We've talked about Bob Smith's role in photography as the companion. If he was your companion and you have a great story about him or an unanswered question about his life, call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard will be right back with more of the Bob Smith story. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to The Story of Bob Smith on KCUR's Central Standard. Bob worked at the Tivoli, as well as Le Fou Frog. He'd been a model in Paris and New York earlier in his life. Let's hear how that career started in Bob's own words.
I arrived in Paris, France, with $100 in my pocket and didn't know anybody. But I went to Vogue. I'd been working for Vogue. They have their own office in Paris. And sure, we can use you as a model.
So he's the kind of guy who just walks into the Vogue offices with his portfolio, doesn't get hired as a designer, but does get hired as a model. He worked with celebrities. They were his friends. Helmut Newton, June Newton, a whole long list of them. He loved them, but he really did especially prefer the companionship of his dogs.
Somebody asked me if somebody could come back from death for one day, and I said, the dogs, Antonio and Massimo. And I think maybe it's true. I miss them every day. Had them 16 years. I crossed three times with them on a boat because I wouldn't put them in a box.
And Bob also, it should be noted, got very seasick, so that he traveled to Europe in a boat for his dogs really says something. That was audio from his hospice video, actually. He died 10 years ago. I'm here with the Tivoli's Jerry Harrington, remembering Bob. Hi again, Jerry.
Hello.
We've also got another Jerry, photographer Jerry Schatzberg, with us from New York. Hi again, also Jerry.
Hi.
So we've got the two Jerrys today. You know, Jerry Schatzberg, you were just talking about Bob's career, and there's a phrase that we know, method acting. Do you think that Bob was on some level a method model?
Oh, absolutely. You know, at the time that Bob was working, I'd say there are only four or five models that did that job, you know, over and over and over. We would book the same people because they were so good at it. And, you know, it's a great help. In my first film called Puzzle of a Downfall Child, I have a scene in there which actually is Bob. It's not exactly Bob, but it is somewhat Bob, and I've restored it for the film, where he's with a model, and they're in an embrace, and no magic is happening. But with Bob, magic would happen, and the way I've written the scene in the film, they excuse themselves, they go back into the dressing room, and the model, who was very friendly with Bob and Saint Marie, She played by Faye Dunaway, she sort of sits him down, gives him a little wine, and says, oh, you know, I think your hair needs a little fixing. Let me comb it. And you see, by the way, she starts to seduce him. She starts to have him react, and the next thing we do is cut to the outside, and the scene is beautiful. Well, Bob could react to any of these things that the other person was feeding him, which is what you do in acting.
Jerry Harrington, from what you have heard about Bob's time in his career, I mean, his relationship with his, I would say celebrity, except that he was kind of an anonymous celebrity to the public, to people who worked in the fashion industry, in photography, in the arts, really, in the international arts, Bob was known. But to the public who saw his face, he wasn't, because he was kind of meant to be the everyman. He was meant to be the companion. He was all these things that we've heard. You weren't supposed to notice him. You were supposed to notice the clothes, you know?
Right.
What do you think was his relationship later in life with that celebrity past? Because really, When I was going to write about him, what he really wanted me to write about was his aunts. He didn't want me to be interested in...
No, he would get irritated if people would pressure him about talking about his more glamorous life in the past. He just, you know, it happened. He never felt it was that important. He never felt like it was some great achievement. It was the past. I mean, Bob was pretty present. One of the most present people I've ever met.
There's a story, you know, his apartment was lined with photographs of both ordinary people, ordinary in the sense of not famous, and his, you know, celebrity friends. They were all equal to him. But these photographs just lined his walls. And there was one of a man named Dick Rutledge who had been a photographer also for Vogue. He had traveled internationally and he always had on an ascot. He had an office in New York and then was moved to Paris and then from Paris to Tokyo. And Bob told me the story that Dick Rutledge had one day woken up, handed his studio keys to his assistant in Tokyo, moved back to Paris, and become a dishwasher in one of Bob's favorite restaurants, and always wore an ascot while washing dishes, causing people to mistake him for the owner of the restaurant. And Bob told me this story over and over again and told me how much he admired this person. And in a way, you can kind of see this parallel. Bob also walked away from all of that.
Yes, he never wanted, I mean, I know people would encourage him to maybe try to get some modeling jobs here in Kansas City, because sometimes people would use him to be like the CEO or whatever, and he just said, no, unless it's something people ask me to do, I'm not really interested anymore.
Jerry Schatzberg, I think it's hard to be doing this conversation about a model without being able to see him. And you've talked about liking to work with Bob because of what he could do on the set, but can you talk to us about his appearance, what he looked like?
Well, he wasn't high sophisticated. He was a little bit more like the boy next door that grew up, you know, and that's the way it was going. And the other Jerry mentioned how natural he was, and that was Bob. And that's what I liked about his work. And to step back a minute, though, about Dick Rutledge leaving the business and Bob feeling that way. It's not a business that has long careers, you know, because the magazines and the people that are deciding whether they want somebody to represent their clothing, they're very fickle, and they sort of drop people before they're 30, 35 even, and now it's even worse because young girls model by the time they're 17 and they're finished when they're 20, 22. Bob had a long career in fashion compared to others. As I mentioned Anne St. Marie, and in those days, the females had a longer career because they didn't have the notoriety, and that's why Bob didn't have that kind of notoriety. Notoriety came in the 80s when we had supermodels and actually it came in the 60s when we knew who Twiggy was and Gene Shrimpton. But my first film is about that. It's exactly about that. It's I was very upset to see so many wonderful models, male and female, who were just dismissed by a magazine by saying, no, we've seen them too much. We have to get somebody new. But considering that, Bob did have a fairly long career.
Before we go, I do want to ask about, Jerry, we've been talking about Bob's career and talking about how, you know, he had this certain level of fame outside of Kansas City, and then he had a different kind of local celebrity that was totally unrelated to his whole career as a model and his brush with famous people. But if you wanted someone to remember the Bob you knew as a friend, what would you want them to remember about him?
His naturalness and the fact that he was a real person. He never had airs about him. He was always Bob.
Yeah.
When he'd come to the studio, he was always Bob when he left the studio. And we'd see each other outside the studio, and He was just a real person.
Other Jerry, what do you say?
I second that. That's exactly Bob.
Well, you can see photos from Bob's career for a few more days at the Tivoli in the lobby of Manor Square. A toast to Bob 10 years after he died. Jerry Harrington, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeannie.
And Jerry Schatzberg, it's been a pleasure talking with you and remembering an old friend.
Thank you. I've learned some things.
Well, this show will be posted on our website, kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it ready for you to listen to later today. And tomorrow, we'll be back with a show about how a generation that's never been without cell phones connects with the great outdoors. That's tomorrow, Connecting Millennials with Nature. Our show's produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Ted Hope, and Jen Chen, with help from Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish, our interns. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.